Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the director, producer and writer John Lloyd. If you've laughed at all over the past 30 years, there's a pretty good chance he's the man you should thank. Spitting Image, Not the 9 o'clock News, Blackadder, QI, they are just a handful of the programmes that he's helped to create. And if the comedy work ever dries up, he could open a shop flogging second-hand BAFTAs. He's won a huge stack of them, and a Grammy, and an Emmy. Which isn't to say it's been an easy ride. Fallouts, multiple sackings and missed opportunities have also peppered his stellar career in comedy. He says, "I like starting things. There are starters and finishers in life. That's the great divide. I like the fight and the passion and the difficulty. Well, I don't like it, but it's what I do." You make it sound, John Lloyd, as if it's almost like you're the midwife at a difficult birth. Would that cover it?
That's a very good line. I think a lot of stuff that I do, in retrospect, it all looks, you know, great and lovely and easy. And I passionately believe that nothing great is achieved without difficulty. Not exclusively true, but the Navajo have a proverb, which is, everything easy is evil, everything difficult is good. And I sort of live by that, really.
In film and TV, I often think it's pretty easy to make people cry. It's very difficult to make them properly laugh. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think laughter is one of the great mysteries of the universe, along with music and consciousness and life itself. I've been asked occasionally to do serious drama, and I think, how would I know when I'd got it right? Whereas comedy, you're flying by wire all the time. It's intuitive and don't quite know where it comes from, but you definitely know it when you see it.
And a very successful career you've had so far, as I said, but not one of unalloyed joy. I mean, there have been a lot of bumps along the way. Are you a tricky character, or is it all the rest of them?
It's all my fault, Kirsty. Yes, I want a bit of a confessional.
Just
here.
As long as we've got that out of the way.
Well, I struggled for a long time, particularly I got a bit lost in my 40s. I struggled to think why I was continually, serially being fired, particularly by people I was very close to. But I'm over that stage now. One of my little mantras is disaster is a gift. Because when you look back on your life, the disaster, you know, being sacked by your girlfriend or your head of department or best friend as a co-writer, you look back and you think, thank goodness that happened. Because if I hadn't been sacked, I would still be there.
Let's have some music, John Lloyd. What's your first track of the day?
My first track is Van Morrison and Bright Side of the Road, and this is the song that Sean Hardy, my co-producer on Not the 9 o'clock News, used to play when things were going really badly, which was quite often.
That was Van Morrison and Bright Side of the Road. So, John Lloyd, I know it's a rather vulgar subject to ask you how many BAFTAs you have exactly, but you have just one less than Dame Judi Dench, isn't that right?
Yes, it's a strange aberration. One year, I think it was 1991, 92, BAFTA decided to have BAFTAs for advertising, and I won six BAFTAs on the same evening. And towards the end of the evening, the booing was heard as I clutched another mask and went back to my seat.
I was going down the list of what you got BAFTAs for, and very interestingly to me, Spitting Image, which got 50 million viewers, critically acclaimed. It was a very populous programme, as well as appealing to the critics and so on, and never won a BAFTA. Did that matter to you?
It just got a bit tedious. We were nominated for years, and you'd turn up, and then once again you would not get a prize. And of course, you know, I was younger then. I was only 30-something, and it did matter to me. It mattered. You think, you can't understand this, because not only did it get huge ratings, but it was... I used to say to MPs when they used to criticise me, people would say, well, you know, if you don't like this country, why don't you go and live in Russia? Why don't you go and live in Russia? And I said, well, that's one of the great advantages of living in a democracy. You're allowed to criticise. And one Tory MP once said to me, you shouldn't be allowed to do this. And I said, well, look, we get every week 1.5 million more viewers than it took to elect the Tory government, which was 13.5 million people it took to elect Mrs. Thatcher's government. So, hey, you know, we are being voted for more than you, and we're being voted on a weekly basis.
You did a very good impression there. You never did any of the voices for it, did you?
No. I would have liked to have done that. I started out meaning to be a writer-performer.
Right.
And somehow along the way, I never asked to be a producer, you know, I got the poison chalice there, but somebody's got to do it.
You said of yourself once, the only thing that is different about me is that I am more determined than other people. And I wonder for determined if we could read sort of tenacious and bloody-minded.
Thank you. I think that's true. And I think the way that I think is I like to be ahead of the curve, you know, one wave ahead. And so nearly all the stuff I've done, the first series has been a thoroughgoing disaster because people say, well, puppets and politics, how does that work? Or a sitcom set in the Middle Ages? Like, oh, that's never going to happen. And it's really trying to get the audience to kind of catch up with you. I do have this powerful sense of vision, particularly when I've come up with many ideas, but the ones I have, it starts with what it will feel like to experience the programme, to listen to or watch it. So not the 9 o'clock news, but it's like going to a rock concert with your best friends and having a really good laugh and going to the pub. That's the feeling. And how you make the programme, you're sort of colouring in the bits.
Let's have some music then, John. What's next?
Well, this is an Irish band called The Waterboys, who I'm very fond of, and a song called The Raggle Taggle Gypsy. And I come from an Anglo-Irish background, at least on my father's side. And he was in the Navy. And so as children, we were shipped all over the world. And so the gypsy side is that sort of wandering sailor's son thing.
There was three old gypsies in the air hall door. They came brave and boldly on. And the one sang high and the other sang low. And the other sang a raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. It was upstairs, there's a lady went. Put on a suit of leather, oh. And there was a cry from around.
That was The Waterboys and The Raggle Taggle Gypsy. To put you in touch, John Lloyd, with, I mean, the early days of your life. You did spend a lot of your life moving from one place to the other. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, my dad was in the Royal Navy. He'd been sent away to Dartmouth at 13 as a child, really, to join the Navy because his uncle, General Hardress Lloyd, who was a general in the First World War, and my father used to say, he said, you can have any career you like, my boy, as long as it's the Navy. So off you go. So my dad went off and he had a brilliant time as a midshipman in the 30s going all around the world. There's a famous line in Blackadder where Hugh Laurie says, up tiddly up, down tiddly down, and back home for tea and medals. And that was based on my father's life in the Navy. And they had this back home for tea and medals life, you know, they'd be based in Felixstowe or Dover and then zoom across the channel at 50 knots, blow up a couple of destroyers or some docks and come home again. And my father once told me this extraordinary story about how they'd come home from an all-night engagement on the Belgian coast, and he had a call on the radio from the CNC saying, Lloyd, the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau, two German pocket battleships, have broken out of Brest, and you are the only British Allied forces between them and getting back to the Kiel Canal, and I order you to go and sink them. And my father's dog-tired. They'd been up all night, and the dawn was just beginning to break. So he said to the coxswain, we've got to turn round and there's two buoys off the coast of Dover, which you've got to be careful to turn round the right one. And because the coxswain was tired, he went round the wrong buoy. And they looked up and they saw this, what looked like an amazing cloud bank ahead of them. And the coxswain said, that's an amazing cloud formation, sir. And my father said, that's not a cloud formation, coxswain, that's the White Cliffs of Dover. And they ran these three boats at 50 knots up the beach, tore off the propellers. And my father got out, aged 22, in his sea boots and thought, not only have I ruined my life and career, but I've lost the war for Britain. And he had called up the CNC and said, I've done this, sir, and I don't know what to say, and I obviously resign immediately or I'm going to be court-martialed. And the guy said, don't worry, Harpy, that was his name. It's fine, everybody makes one mistake, but don't make another one. And my father used to say, the thing is, John, at the time it was a disaster, but if we had attacked those boats, every single man on that crew would be dead.
And what do you remember of him as a father?
Well, he was, you know, he was terribly genial, you know, very decent, genial fellow. but he was kind of, in a way, always at sea, do you know what I mean? In the nicest way. He had very, very blue eyes, and he'd be off, even when he was at home, thinking of being at sea. Because he was the youngest captain in the Navy, oddly. So I don't remember him as anything other than this commanding, cheerful figure. And particularly when I first went to prep school, age 9 or 10, and he would sweep in the Royal Naval limo with a, you know, sailor driver and all that, and get out, and the great big, you know, four bars of gold on raid on his, "Hello, old horse, hello, pop in the car." No, he was terrific.
So much more to come, John, but we've got to get the music in too. We're on your third piece. Tell us about this.
Well, this is The Love and Spoonful and Do You Believe in Magic? And it reminds me of the innocent optimism of the early 60s.
Do you believe in magic? Young girl's heart, how the music can free her whenever it starts, and it's magic if the music is groovy and makes you feel happy like an old time movie. I'll tell you about the magic and it'll free your soul, but it's like trying to tell a stranger about a rock and roll. Believe in magic, don't bother to choose if it's jug band music or rhythm and blues, just go.
That was The Love and Spoonful and Do You Believe in Magic? So, John Lloyd, you were sent away to school. You went to prep school. At what age?
I suppose it was about 9 and a half, something like that. So it was a horrific first day when you see your parents driving off and you realise you're stuck with it. You know, bullying, for example, that was just endemic. I mean, everybody beat each other up all the time and usually became best friends with the little boy you just socked in the eye, and then you were got the slipper the whole time, and it was not enough to eat, and we all suffered from scurvy. And as somebody said, anyone who's been through the English public school system never really feels ill at ease in prison.
You said there you were hungry. I mean, they must have fed you, obviously.
Yeah, there was never really enough food, or certainly not enough edible food. At my prep school, there was a grating that ran round the dining room called limbo, from the, you know, Latin for purgatory. Mm. And if the food was particularly gross, the teacher at the end of the table said, "Down, limbo." It was fine. If even the teacher couldn't eat the stuff, it went down the grating. God knows where it went after that. So, yeah, it was quite, you know, very thin blankets on the beds. And the trick was to smuggle food into the school. So cress seeds, for example, were immensely prized. You could get some in your pencil box and disguise it, you know, put it under the protractor, and then you grow cress on your flannel in your locker, which is the only private space you had.
Can I be clear you're not making this up?
No, certainly not. For example, a potato was like, you know, a gold ingot, and if we could get a raw potato, we'd sneak into the woods at the weekends and somehow light a little fire and cook this potato and share it out between four of us. We used to eat conkers. I'm not joking.
I'm absolutely astonished by this. Did you tell your parents you were hungry?
Well, yeah. But you usually forget, you know, you've got a sort of short memory if you're 9 or 10, that the awful thing that happened last Friday has been long been surpassed by the fact that you came first in the hurdles on sports day, or that you went on a trip to the beach in the master's sports car.
You've said you went on to King's School, Canterbury, and you've said of that time, 5 years like a prison sentence, violent, nasty, extremely lonely and difficult. Did it mark you?
Actually, no, I don't really feel that. I mean, it's left me with a real resentment of authority wielded unfairly or wrongly. That's the thing that gets me really cross. Because of the days when you're 15 and you're told, you know, "Go to your room, Lloyd, I'm going to beat the backside off you." And one guy actually took a run-up. He stood on the sofa and jumped down onto the sofa and gave me 6, you know, in my pyjama bottoms. You know, you think that's not right. But at the time, you're so used, you're inured to it because of the years in prep school where, for example, all our letters were censored. You know, you'd write, "Dear Mummy and Daddy, I'm terribly unhappy because, you know, Bolsover has stolen my set of dividers and you know, I came last in maths." And you'd take it up to the teacher and he'd say, "Well, you can't say this." It was like, censorship during the war. Go write that you're having a lovely time and you've got in the cricket team. So you get used to that, and you get used to the idea that there's nothing to be done. You've just got to sort of sit it out somehow and hope it will eventually come to an end, which, of course, you know, eventually it did. And I got to Cambridge, and I honestly thought that I had died and gone to heaven. I mean, you just thought, this can't be right. Everyone you meet is nice. There's no physical punishment. You can stay out till 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's fine.
Let's have some music, John. What's next?
Well, this is called Sister Golden Hair, and it's by a band called America, and it reminds me of being a young radio producer in the mid-70s, and I used to play this song as often as I could on a show called Late Night Extra on Radio 2, where we normally had to do sing something simple and lots of sort of BBC ooh-wop, very old-fashioned music, and I was allowed occasionally to play the Beatles or songs like this.
That was America and Sister Golden Hair. So you said earlier, John Lloyd, that you thought in the beginning, when you started working professionally, that you might be a performer, you might be in front of the mic and in front of the camera. That started, did it, at university at Cambridge? Were you performing there?
Yeah, I did a bit at school too. I acted in the first play that King's Canterbury ever put on since it was founded by St. Augustine in 597 or so. The first play to have real girls. Oh, that was marvellous. Oh,
I'll let you enjoy the memory for just one more moment. But at Cambridge then, who were you acting alongside?
College Review was a very cool thing to be in, and Trinity Review I got into in my first year. And then the second year, we asked the sort of doyen of Footlights, who was a girl called Mary Allen, to come and do the closing number of the show that we'd put on. And I instantly fell completely in love with her, and so that was the rest of my university career written off with a sort of big romance, and she persuaded me to have a go at going into Footlights.
What were you supposed to be studying?
Law.
And where are you at all?
I'm afraid not. I was very ill-disciplined. And I found in the middle of my second year that what I really like doing is writing jokes.
And so what happened was you started working at the BBC once you left university, and one of the first people that you worked with there was Douglas Adams on the very first Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. How did it come about in the very beginning?
Well, Douglas and I actually shared a house together. We used to write in the evenings. I'd go off and, you know, produce radio shows like Just a Minute and so on during the day and come back, and Douglas would be in the bath with a cup of tea waiting for me to come back so we could write something together. And he got a bit stuck after the first four shows, and he said, "Oh, I've run out of jokes. Can you give us a hand?" And so we wrote the last two shows together, which was really good fun.
And then you didn't go on to the subsequent success that it had in television. What happened?
No, well, well, Douglas basically wrote me a letter saying he thought it was much better when he was writing it on his own, and thank you for all your help, but I think probably better if I did it on my own. I was very cross at the time and very hurt. You think, Douglas, you could have just stuck your head round the door and said, by the way, you're surplus to requirements, but he didn't.
But you didn't say to him, can we just sit down and talk about this for half an hour?
Well, I did. He stopped me in the corridor and said, "Johnny, are you all right?" And I said, "No, I'm really cross. I can't understand what's gone on." He said, "Well, you got paid, didn't you?" He really didn't get it. So he said, well, what you should do is go and get an agent. So I did. I went and got an agent, and my agent said, "We can basically get this guy for half of everything with the name Hitchhiker on it forever." And I said, no, I don't want that. I just want..." By that time, we'd been commissioned to write the first Hitchhiker book. I want my half of the advance. So that's what we did.
And you got it?
I got it, yeah. But anyway, you know, you're young, you get over it pretty quickly.
And did you become proper friends again, or was there always the sense in which you felt you couldn't quite be the good friends you'd been before?
No, it never was quite the same, but it wasn't difficult because we went on. We'd both booked this place in Corfu to go and write the first book. That's how serious it was and why it's so surprising. And that's where The Meaning of Life came from, this book that we wrote together, because when Douglas got tired of writing his novel, he used to come down to the bar and we'd play various kind of games, and that was one of them. Think of a funny... What does this place name mean? You know, what's an Epping? And so that eventually became a book. So once again, you know, that would never have happened if we hadn't fallen out.
We're going to have some music. We've got to fit it in, otherwise we'll never get to the end of this
no,
programme.
It's getting much more confessional than I intended, Kirsty. You've lured me. This next song is The Crystals and Daduron Ron, and it was, I think, the almost the first musical number we did at Spitting Image with Ronnie Reagan, who was kind of the hero of the program, along with Mrs. T and Nancy on Nancy doing the singing, and we changed all the words to make them funny, but it always makes me think of that time.
That was the Crystals and A Do Run Run. Let's talk for a minute then, John Lloyd, about the wonderful Spitting Image. As you say, it became required viewing. How did it start out?
Well, it was actually very difficult to get a commission. I think we went to almost every single ITV company and everyone said, no, it's a kid's stuff. And Central said, we like 22. And we can't make 22. We haven't got enough time to do it. But when I came from radio, I knew lots of people who did funny voices, but I didn't know anyone who looked like the people who did the funny voices of. So in Not the 9 o'clock News, we decided we wanted to have some puppets. And I went to see Roger Law and said, I understand you can do caricatures. And he said, yeah. And I said, can you make a puppet for us? And he said, well, I might be able to. How much have you got? And I said, well, about £200. And he just laughed, you know, said, no thanks. So years later, I heard that a guy called Martin Lambinan had put up some money to build the first puppet. And I rushed over to see Roger again, and I literally begged him. I said, I've got to do this. I'm the only person, probably in the world, who has the production experience to do this particular thing. And then I remember spending most of the first year writing myself letters begging to be fired from this complete disaster. But, you know, it turned out to be this extraordinary, iconic thing.
And not only was it a huge success in your career, but, it, I mean, it almost did for the careers of quite a few politicians. You know, there was, of course, always the David Owen with little David by his side, you know, sort of picking up his bags and saying, thank you, David.
Yes,
thank
David, you. When it comes to the name of the party leader, we're going to take half of your name and half of my name. From my name, we're going to take the word Owen, and from your name, we're going to take the word David. Oh, yes. Oh, thank you so much, David. I'm so pleased. But actually, I think David Steele's the only... He's certainly the only politician on record who said that it hurt his career.
Well, I can't think, when it came to John Major, that showing him with his pants over his suit really helped his career at all. Did any politicians ever sort of buttonhole you personally and say, you know, it's too harsh, it's too offensive, it's too cynical?
Yeah, but they did occasionally, but nothing to do with... You could say that somebody was totally corrupt, that they, you know, they'd committed murder even, and they didn't mind at all. They'd chuckle in a sort of knowing way. If you said they had a big nose, oh, no, that's really below the belt.
And remind us of some of the people that were doing the voices. I mean, they were people who went on to have very big comedy careers.
The alumni are amazing. Chris Barry, John Sessions, Harry Enfield. We gave Harry his first job, in fact. I met him because a friend of mine called Anthony Wall, who produced Arena, said this very strange guy had come to see him. And he can do all the voices from the 1950s. So I met Harry and I got on very well with him. And the first two or three editions of Spitting Image, there was always some 50s voiceover in it because we couldn't think what on earth to do with him. And then suddenly he cottoned on. He got David Steele and he got Leon Britton and Douglas Hurd. And until somebody, you know, like a Rory Bremner or Harry Enfield comes along, they don't seem to have a silly voice. And then you can never listen to Douglas Hurd again without thinking of that extraordinary ice cream cone on his head, you know.
Let's have some more music then, John. What's next? We're on your sixth disc.
Well, my life suddenly took a turn for the better in 1989 when I got married to my wonderful wife, Sarah. Hello, darling. And it was truly, Kirsty, the best wedding there has ever been in the history of the world. And this music is the music that my wife-to-be came down the aisle to. Thank you.
The Arrival of the Queen of Sheba by Handel, performed by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. So, John Lloyd, that was a tribute to your wedding day.
I think anyone who was there will remember it. And at the end of the wedding, as we walked back down the aisle, Howard Goodall at the organ was playing Bach's Toccata and Fugue, and it ran into the Blackadder theme. And the whole church cheered. It was like a football crowd. They went, "Yes!" And I was so happy I picked Sarah up in her wedding dress and spun her round. And everyone was just, "This is so much fun."
So, John Lloyd, there came a point, and I don't really understand this. I read that in your early 40s, you sort of hit a wall. You hit a wall of thinking, what's it all about? It sounds as though you had a beautiful and happy life. What happened?
Well, we did, and that was the odd thing. After we'd been married for about 3 years, I just woke up one Christmas Eve and I thought, I can't see the point of anything at all. It was the most alarming thing, and particularly alarming because I had everything. I'm happily married at that point, I think, 2 children. We had a lovely flat in Fulham, and we had a little cottage in the country and a couple of cars, and I'd, as you know, a ridiculous number of BAFTA awards. I couldn't fit all the awards into my study. We had so many. And then one day I thought, I don't know what I'm supposed to be aiming at. And I went, you know, right down to the bottom. I'm depressed. Depressed is a word that people say, "Oh, yeah, I get depressed." Well, you just can't see the point of anything. And I used to sit under my desk crying for no reason. It was quite extraordinary. And what was particularly annoying for somebody like me, who always likes a reason for things, I'm logical. If there's a good reason, fine. And there wasn't a reason. Put me into a fantastic tailspin, and I'd had this kind of almost perfect career for 15 years. And I used to think, that's because of me, because I'm very determined, I work hard, I won't give up, and I used to take credit for it to some extent. And then I had 10 years of complete disaster. Nothing that I did worked. I tried to set a radio station in 1992, that took a year. We raised £4 million, we had a brilliant board, 100 comedians signed up, Radio Authority wouldn't give us a license. I got a job writing a film for Paramount. Finished the first draft, and the head of Paramount threw it in the swimming pool because it was late and no movie. And it was just, this went on. It got ridiculous, like one felt one was being shot at for something one hadn't done.
And so in the depths of this clinical depression, within that, the seeds of QI, the seeds of thinking, I want to make a programme where I start to understand the world and help other people understand it. Is that fair?
Yes, and it didn't start like that. It started out, I want to know what the meaning of life is. There must be some better reason to go on than, as it were, the split between science knows everything and the little baby Jesus. There must be somewhere that a normally intelligent person can sign up to that works. And I started reading, actually, physics to begin with. I wanted to know, actually, how is the universe constructed? Mm-hmm. And when you discover there are other ways to be and other ways to think and other ways to relate to people and your children and you know, your friends, you start to build a sort of wobbly kind of, at first, philosophy. And QI is the byproduct of that, because I read so much. I read so much science and history and, you know, biology and chemistry, and I knew I'd gone round the bend when I bought a big, fat Dutch dictionary and started reading it from page one. And so QI is a sort of spin-off of a search for ultimate meaning.
And on that note, we have to fit in the discs, so we're going to go to some music. Seems rather banal after what we've just been talking about, but anyway, it is Dire Straits. Tell me about the next piece of music.
Well, this is Walk of Life, probably not one of their most known songs, but the one that reminds me of driving in our Land Rover. We moved to the country, and so often I'd be driving the kids, Harry, Coco and Bootsy, in this Land Rover with this song playing an absolutely full blast.
Was Dire Straits and Walk of Life. And in a sense, John Lloyd, you did sort of, you walked away the weight of that depression. You were somebody who found that actually getting up and getting out every day and walking for literally a couple of hours would help you begin to make sense.
Well, I'm definitely of the walk-it-off school of psychiatry, you know. My father would say, don't be so feeble, John, get on with it, or, you know, look it up, he'd say, about books, you know. So I refused to admit that I was mad or mentally deranged in any way. It seemed to me that it was a perfectly logical situation. I'd been badly treated by a few people, and I was, you know, depressed and angry because I was right. And that discovering through physics and mathematics and thinking, hang on, there's a completely other way of looking at this. And I don't understand why we are not all taught, you know, proper global philosophy at school. And I think I'm one of the very few people who has a proper thought-through philosophy.
And so QI has been the byproduct of this and a huge success on television, but your life and your philosophical journeying has led you to a point of feeling that you can make sense of things and that you have a personal philosophy that makes not just sense, but helps to give you a sense of optimism.
Well, the universe is a paradoxical beast. It's very complicated, but it's also very simple. There's one of the paradoxes. It's immensely complicated and so simple it can be written down as E equals MC squared. So, yeah, no, I have a working philosophy that helps me deal with my kids if they get upset or, you know, how I relate to my wife or to even to you. And it changed my views about, you know, I used to think that being intelligent was a really good thing to be. And being kind was a bit for weeds, you know. Well, what kind? That doesn't win any awards. Now you think, that's an absurd position. Intelligence is something you're given. That's something you can't take credit for something you have to start with. Kindness, that takes effort. Cheerfulness, that matters. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It's in the Bible, you know. It doesn't have to be a theistic philosophy. I don't subscribe to any one religion. But the idea that there's a way of living which is better than the one that we read about in the newspapers, it's a shame that that isn't taught at school.
The working life you've had then is not the working life you expected to have when you set out at the beginning. Do you look at it with a sense of achievement, a sense of contentment at this point?
I do have a tremendous sense of contentment. It's been hard-earned some of the time, but I can truthfully say I wake up every day and I say I'm so grateful to be alive and I'm so grateful that I've still got things to say and to do, you know, and there's a lot more to do, I think.
Well, John, your final piece of music is something of a counterpoint to all of that optimism. Tell me what it is and why you've chosen it.
Well, this is, given the foregoing rather sort of soupy blather, this is a wonderful song by my friend Mark Fry. And this is from his second album, Shooting the Moon, and it's a song called Regrets.
All the mountains I never climbed, the bad feelings I left behind, all the girls I never kissed, and all the shooting stars I missed. When I think of all the nights I never knew, all the heavens I never flew.
That was Mark Fry and Regrets. So, John, we come to the point where I'm going to give you the books, of course. You get the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book along.
Well, I've chosen a book called The Book on the Taboo Against Being Who You Are. And it's by a guy called Alan Watts. And it is the best book I've ever read on the nature of what actually is, what the world is about, and how you should behave.
Right, that's your book then, and a luxury too.
Well, my luxury is, I hope it's allowed, it's one of those things you see in garden centres, which has got it's a big whirligig and it's festooned with literally hundreds of packets of seeds, you know, radishes and geraniums, hollyhocks, you know, forget-me-nots. I just plant, you know, one a day and just see, because I used to love gardening when I was a kid and I haven't had any time for like about 50 years to do gardening.
Yes, and they allow you that.
Thank you.
And if you had to pick just one track, which one would you pick?
Well, I think it would just have to be the Van Morrison, the first track, Bright Side of the Road, because every time I hear that, it lifts the heart, doesn't it? It makes you want to sing and dance, and that's what everybody's life should be like.
It does, and it's yours. John Lloyd, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Kirsty. Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.